So starting here on the bottom of Ayin Chedamut Bet by the wide lines, Melech Vakala Yechatsu Et Pneihem. Matznit and Mani. Who's the author of this position within the Mishnah that the Melech and the Kala have a dispensation to wash their faces on Yom HaKippurim? So Rabbi Chananya ben Tradyom, he detanya Melech Vakala Lo Yechatsu Et Pneihem. We have a braita that tells us that the Melech and Kala may not wash their faces. Rabbi Chananya ben Tradyom Omer, Mishum Rabbi Eliezer, Amelech Vakala Yechatsu Et Pneihem. Achaya lo tinol et sandal. Rabbi Chananya ben Tradyon omer mishum Rabbi Eliezer, achaya tinol et sandal. So these are both of the positions that we find in the Mishnah. One is the dispensation for the king to wash his face. Number two is for a kala to wash her face. And the third one, which is mentioned here, is that the Tanna Kamma believes that a chaya, a woman who is post-pregnancy, may not avoid the inui of not wearing a sandal. She must not wear her shoes. Whereas Rabbi Chananya ben Tradyon says that she can wear shoes when she's post-pregnancy. Maryas, my daima. Amar Rabbi Abba bar Zavda, Amar Rav. Inside there, you can see the Girsa Tarif adds in that header, and then they say, my daima, the kala, but ours starts with my daima and melech. So we have it the opposite way around. My time of melech, mishum, melech biyofyo techazena inecho. That the king has a certain stature and appearance that is expected, and therefore, again, he's washing his face not for his own benefit, he's washing his face for the benefit of his subjects. His subjects expect the king to appear in a certain manner, and to present a certain face to the public, and because of that, he washes his face. So again, why this is allowed on Yom Kippur, we've discussed numerous times. Again, either because you think, as the Rabbeinu Tam, that this is all Dirabbanan, and therefore the Dirabbanan can determine this. Or you think like the Ran, the Ramban, that the Chachamim were granted the right to decide the Doraita, and therefore again, the Rabbanan decided that this was okay. Or you have the Yireim who says that Rechitzat Kol Gufo is the only problem Doraita, everything else is Dirabbanan. Or the fact that this is not Rechitza Shel Tanu. This is not pleasurable washing. Again, he's not washing his face for his own benefit. He's washing his face because of his public appearance. That he's got to go out in the public and he's got to appear in a certain way. And the same will apply to the kala as well over here. Kala my taimo. What's the reason behind the kala? Kadesh lo tidgane al bala. She's newly married and she wants to present her best face forward in order to get the marriage off on a good foot, a good footing. And therefore, for the first 30 days, she has this dispensation. Again, for all the same reasons that we might see by Melech. Amale Rav the Rabbi Chia, kala ad kama. How long does a kala consider to be a kala? Amalei kidetanya. Ein monim takshitim in a kala kol shloshim yom. That we don't hold back takshitim from a kala for 30 days. That's a braita that's brought in the Gemara and Ketubot with regards to a wedding that's about to take place, and then either the Chatan's father or the mother of the Kala passes away, and now they're in a situation where the meal's prepared, everything's ready to go, and now one of them became an avil. So can they go through with the marriage? So over there, the Gemara discusses, they go through with the marriage, and then afterwards they bury the mate, and then they have the Sheva Brochos and the Avelut afterwards. It's a whole process which we'll get to when we get to the Gemara Ketubot. So over there it says that even though the Kala might be an Avela, that she might be an Avelut at that time, we don't hold back her Tachshitim for the first 30 days. Despite the fact that she's an Avelut, we don't want her again to be Nitgane al Bala. So she has the status of a Kala for the first 30 days. Achaya tinolat sandal mishum tzina, because of the cold. Because if she walks barefoot, cold might affect her. And that is something that we would consider to be possibly dangerous. Even if it's not dangerous, we still have these dispensations that we spoke about before. But again, the wearing of the shoes here, whether it's because it's the Rabbanan interpreting Doraita, or there might be, the Tosfot Yishanim suggested maybe there's a difference between sandal and min'al. He rejects it, but he does say there are those that suggest it. Or the last is, which is that for her, it's the problem is not a problem of tanu, walking with shoes, but rather the tzina, the cold on the floor, which would be detrimental to her, even though it's not sakana. So wearing the shoes is just preventing the cold on her feet, not giving her the pleasure of walking around. Amashmol, imachmat sakanat akrav mutar. It says that if it's a place where walking around is dangerous, dangerous because of the possibility of getting bitten by a scorpion or by a snake, and there are dangerous things on the ground, then you can wear the shoes to protect your feet. So again, you're not wearing the shoes for the tanug, you're wearing the shoes simply as protection. So the Ramah brings this down. Halacha says that as much as possible, you should avoid it and avoid wearing shoes. He discusses also the case of muddy roads. And there a day where it wasn't a paved road and it rained. If you go out on the muddy roads, can you wear shoes to protect your feet to go out there? Which would be similar to this case. It's simply for the protection of your feet so they don't get dirty, not because you're wearing shoes for the pleasure of shoes. So because of that, there are these dispensations. On the other hand, he advises against it and he says that preferably that you shouldn't do it. And if you do it, some of the poskim say that you should do it in a way that's uncomfortable. For instance, putting little pebbles, sand or something into the shoes. So the shoes function in terms of their protection, but they don't give you any tanug, that they still function as inui. And just in discussing the shoes, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and others discussed the fact that why is it only that leather shoes are precluded and not other forms of shoes? So it might not have to do with as much of the tanug inui as the other things, but rather Rav Shlomo Zalman brings that the wearing of shoes that are made of leather is a sign of man's dominion over animal. The fact that you walk on the leather, that's the ultimate sign that we have dominion over the animal kingdom, and we're utilizing the animals for our benefit. We're walking on them, we step on them. And so the taking off of the shoes is a sign, whether it's on Tisha B'Av and whether it's on Yom Kippur, that we're not exactly on top anymore, meaning that we are in a position of humility and humbleness now. We're asking for kapara, coming beseeching Hashem for help, and we don't want to act in a way that shows any hubris or any dominion, and therefore we take ourselves down to a position where we don't walk on leather shoes. And that might be some of the explanation for the difference between why only leather shoes are precluded and not other shoes, even though the Gemara itself brings it out of the term inui, which indicates that there is a certain amount of inui. Now, whether the inui is because of the discomfort or the inui is because we don't demonstrate our dominion over the animal kingdom, that might be a form of inui as well, meaning that we take ourselves back, we humble ourselves, and that might be the reason over here again why not wearing shoes is important. And over here, these ideas of sakanat akrav and the sandal for the kaya may not necessarily go against that, because they're simply being worn to protect our feet, not as a sign of our position or dominion. All right, so now the Gemara moves on to the violations of Achila in the Mishnah. It says, O'echelet kotevet agasa. Someone who eats a fat date's worth has violated the inui of Achila on Yom HaKippurim. So, Bayra Papa, the very difficult question, he says, Kekotevet shamru bigarinata o below garinata. This fat date that we're talking about in the Mishnah, does it include its pit or does it not include its pit? The difficulty in the question, everybody raises it, Rashi raises it on the spot, is the Mishnah says, Kogevet hagasa vigarinata. The Mishnah explicitly says that it is a fat date with its seed in it. So then what is Rav Papa's question? Rashi suggests that the question is, did the Mishnah literally mean kogevet hagasa vigarinata, fat date with its pit in it? Or is the Mishnah vigarinata mean and, but and meaning and or? Does it mean kogevet hagasa or garinata? We're going to see later in the Gemara today that the size of the pits nearly match the size of the date. And because of that, Rashi says that maybe that's the reading of the Mishnah. The Mishnah is Kotevet Agasa, which is one measurement. Oh, Uki Garinata is the second measurement. They're the same measurement, but you can measure it in either one of those two ways. And that's Rav Papa's question here. Is Garinata part of the Kotevet Agasa, or is it the other way to measure the Kotevet Agasa? Tosafot does not like Rashi's explanation. He just said, first of all, chances that the pit and the fat date are the same size is very low. He says, if that's the case, it should have said the lesser of those two shiurim. It's whichever one is smaller, that should have been the guiding post here. So therefore, he says that probably is not the explanation. He gives two alternative explanations. He brings one from the Rabbeinu Tam, which is, when we say over here, the din of Kotevet Agasa Garinata, does that mean a Kotevet Agasa with its pit? That's one possibility. Or does it mean Kotevet Agasa, of course, with its pit? Vigarinata means another pit. So does it mean a Kotevet Agasa with a pit plus a pit? Because the Garinata, is that the Garinata of the Kotevet Agasa that you're talking about? Or is it an additional pit that is mentioned here? So that's the way he explains the question. The also quotes from the Oruch, who quotes from Rav Nissim Gaon, who suggests another explanation, which is based on the Yushalmi. The Yushalmi says, when you have a date, between the pit and the flesh of the date, there's actually airspace there. Internally, there's a halal, there's an air pocket between them. And so there, the Yushalmi, the airspace doesn't count. But then he says, maybe that's the question of Rav Papa over here. When we say, Kekotevet Agasa Vigarinata, or below Garinata, doesn't literally mean with its pit or without its pit, but what does it mean with that airspace between the pit? Do you look at it as a whole, Kekotevet Agasa Vigarinata, the date as a whole, which would include that airspace? Or do you look at it as below Garinata, not with the Garin inside, but separated out? Meaning, do you compress it and say that I have the Kotevet and I have the seed separately? So three different ways to read the question of Rav Papa because of the problem in the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, V'garinata. So it's clear that we have a pit here. The question is, what's the question of Rav Papa? So those are the three different ways to deal with it. So, Bai Rav Ashi, Etzem Kisora. When we talk about, in terms of Tumata mate, a bone from a mate is mitameh b'maga b'masa if it's the size of a sora, the size of barley seed. It's not mitameh b'ohel in that case, but just maga b'masa. But that guide is a sora, barley seed. Is that barley seed beklipata or below klipata? Does it have the shell on it, or is it shelled? I mean, without the shell. Bilecha or beyvesha. Is it a moist barley seed, or are we talking about a dried out barley seed? Here you have a question from Rav Papa about the Kotevet Agasa, and a question from Rav Ashi about the Seora. So Gemara wants to know why each one asks on their particular case and not the other. Rav Ashi, lo mi bayilei hadra papa. Rav Ashi didn't have any question about Rav Papa's issue. Gasa ikmar. Hokama de gaso. Why did the Mishnah specifically say gaso, meaning a fat date? That means the bigger, the better. So the bigger, the better means we're going to take the largest shiur that you could possibly envision over here. So for Rashi, that means that you have the date with its pit in it. According to Rabbeinu Tam, that means the date, the pit, and another pit. And for the Rabbeinu Nisim and the Oroch, that is that you have a date with its pit and its airspace that's in there. Rav Papa, lo mi bayilei had Rav Ashi. Rav Papa didn't ask Rav Ashi's question because lecha shibolet mikre. It's not called barley if it's still moist. If it's still moist, it's called a shibolet, whether it means it's encapsulated or it's on its stalk. That's not called a barley seed. A barley seed is when it's dried out. Shalobi klipata, if it's shelled barley seeds, ushla mikre, it's not called a barley seed anymore, it's called ushla or hushla. There's a different name for shelled barley seeds. The verse says barley seeds when they have their shell on them. So because of that, he doesn't ask the question over here. And now we have Amar Ravo, it's Amar Rabo, Amar Rav Yehuda. Kotevet Agasa Shamru, Yitera Mikibetza. Kotevet Agasa, we're speaking over here, where is it in vis-a-vis other shiurim that we know? We're familiar with a shiurim like Kazayit, Kibetza. Those are things that we use regularly, and they're used in other places. We find them all over Shas. This Kotevet Agasa, this is the only time that we find it in Shas. So where is it relative to these other items? So he suggests it's slightly bigger than a beitza. V'kim lehu rabbanon, debahochei mitvadate. And that is, elocha lemoshe misinai, or empirically, that's what they understood, the rabbanon, that this is what causes a person to be satisfied, but not just satisfied, but his mind at ease. So inui is when your mind is not at ease. So to put your mind at ease, you have to have a certain quantity of food, and that would relieve you of the pain or the anxiety or the difficulty of fasting. So they say that that's the size of Kotevet Agasa. That's what it means. Kim lehu derabbanon, about this size. Batzir mihachi lo mitvadate. Less than that, even though eating is considered achila in other places, for instance, a gazayit is considered achila throughout the Torah. You're right, you're eating, but you're not in violation of inui. Two different things. The requirement here is not to not eat. The requirement here is not to be at ease. It's to be in a state of inui. And you cannot remove that until you reach that level. Right, Meitave. Maase ve'viyo the Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai litom et ha'tavshil. Oder Gamliel shtei kotvot. This is on Sukkos. They wanted them to eat something, so they brought Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai to taste some of the dishes they're going to serve. They brought Rabbi Gamliel two dates, v'dili shamayim, and a pitcher of water. Ve'amru helum le'sukkah. They said, take them up to the sukkah. The sukkah on that day, why they say helum was because the sukkot were on their roofs, because they had flat roofs, and the place to put the sukkah to be in a place where it's exposed would be on the roof. So generally, their sukkot were found on the roofs. They said, bring it up to the sukkah, we're going to go eat in the sukkah. Now, Batani Allah, this is not part of the Mishnah itself. Interesting, because Tosafot, it's on the Amud Bed here. This Tani Allah must not have been in the Gemara for Tosafot, because Tosafot says, right away it reads, Lo mi pnei shalacha kach, and he says, don't think that's part of the Mishnah. He says, that's not in the Mishnah over there. So it's obviously later on, they added in Batani Allah to avoid that problem, and so they didn't think this was in the Mishnah. But Tosafot, here so in the Gemara, clearly did not have Tani Allah in it, because otherwise, why would he have made the point that it's not in the Mishnah? But easier to read it with Vitani Allah, to tell you, lo mi pnei shalacha kach, not because halachically they were required to do that, hashratzu lachmir latzman. They wanted to be machmir on themselves to eat in the sukkah. They didn't want to eat outside of the sukkah. A little tavshil, you could have eaten outside of the sukkah. Two kotavot, you could have eaten outside of the sukkah. Delish shamayim, you could have eaten outside of the sukkah. But they were makpid that they wanted to eat all their food in the sukkah, so they took it up there. But they didn't want to suggest that that example was halacha. That example was someone who was machmir. They gave Rabbi Tzadok food that was less than a kibetza. Number one, he did not take it with his hands, But he took it with a napkin, with a cloth over his hands. Ve'achlo chutz le'sukah. He ate it outside of the sukkah. Ve'lo berech acharav. And he did not make a brocha acharona afterwards. Here we're talking about less than a kabetza of bread. Something that he would have to make hamotzi on. Hamotzi you're required to eat in the sukkah. But because it was less than a kabetza, he didn't have to eat in the sukkah because that's less than the shiur that you have to go into the sukkah for. Number two is natlom mapat. You have to wash until it's yadayim in order to eat bread. You can't eat bread without washing your hands. Now he believed that it was less than a kabetza, you didn't have to wash your hands, and we had the dispensation of using a mapa. Rashi explains it that this is a regular case of bread. And the kulo here is that he didn't wash his hands for bread because it was less than a kabetza, and we let him use a napkin to hold it because we're not worried about you coming into the contact with the bread in that small size. If it's a larger size, we're worried about you coming into contact with the bread, and therefore you'd have to wash it and can't use a mapa. Tosafot says he doesn't think that's such a strong position that Rashi has because Rabbi Tzadok was a Kohen. And it's very possible that he was eating truma over here. And this has nothing to do with the Netilat Yadayim that we know of for bread. Rather, that he didn't want to eat truma, the Tumat Yadayim. His Yadayim are Sheni the Tumah, and automatically for truma. So in order not to touch the truma, he used a mapa instead of washing his hands. Now, with larger sizes, maybe he couldn't have done it. But at least in the smaller sizes, he's willing to do it. But that would not prove anything to us about Netilat Yadayim for Hamotzi, because that was particular to Truma and Rabbi Tzadok Zoglein. So it makes a difference how you read it in terms of the implications for our washing today or not washing for certain sizes of bread. So that's number two. Number three is no berech acharav. He did not make a bracha achrona. It's a machloket in the Gemara in brachot as to what is the threshold to force a birkat hamazon. Is it a kazayit or a kabetza? He's obviously holding like the opinion that says it's a kabetza and therefore he did not make a bracha achrona. So you have three kulot over here. Number one is he didn't wash his hands, but he held it in the napkin. Rashi says, because of an inut hadat, he did it. But again, Tosafot believes that it's a real tumah issue, that he did it because it was truma. He ate outside of the sukkah, because it's less than a kabetza, which tells you what is the threshold that you must eat in the sukkah? Kabetza. And number three is that he didn't make a bracha achrona. He thinks the threshold for birkat hamazon is kabetza, and therefore he didn't make a birkat hamazon. The question is obvious from here, which is, what is the threshold for sukkah? Kabetza. We just said before that we brought the Mishnah down, that when it came to Rabbi Gamliel, he got shteichot vot. He got two dates. And the Gemara says he went up to the sukkah, even though the halacha didn't require him to go up to the sukkah. What do you mean the halacha doesn't require him to go up to the sukkah? You just told me before that a kotevet is bigger than the size of a kabetza. And now he has two kotevot. He has two dates. What do you mean he doesn't halachically require to go up to the sukkah? He has food that's greater than the size of a kabetza. He should have had to gone up to the sukkah. That's the Gemara's question over here. If you think a kotevet is greater than the size of a kabetza, and he had two kotevot, and here Rabbi Tzadok only didn't go up because he had less than a kabetza, then Rabbi Gamliel should have gone up halachically to the sukkah, and not just done it because he was being machmir. The Gemara says, ha kabetza ba'i sukkah. You're telling me from Rabbi Tzadok that a kabetza requires a sukkah. If you're telling me this kotevet agasa is greater than a kabetza, hashta shteikot vod below garinin, lo av a kabetza? So he says, let's say that they're without their pits. Maybe you can get around and say, oh, they're two kotevot without their pits. But you're going to tell me they don't at least make it to the size of a kabetza over here, two kotevot? When you tell me a kotevet with its garin makes it to the size of greater than a kabetza, then certainly two kotevot without their garinim are going to make it to the size of a greater than a kabetza. It says, kotevet hagasa b'garinita miyabi yotera mikabetza? How could you suggest that a kotevet hagasa with its pit is greater than a kabetza if two kotevot without their garinim don't even get to a size of a kabetza? The ratios just don't work. Amar Abirma in. Shtei kotevot below garinatam lo havi kabetza. You're right. There is such a distinction. Two dates without their pits do not get to the size of a kabetza. Kotevet agasa v'garinata aviyotera mikabetza. On the other hand, a kotevet agasa with its garin in it is yotera mina kabetza. Number one, it's gasa. It's a fat date, rather than maybe regular dates. Number two is it has its garin in it. Papa anu damre inche, a colloquial expression. Tre kavi de tamre, if you have two kav worth of tamarim, kan kavi de kashiato v'sariach. Then when you pit them, and you weigh or take the measurement of the pits, they turn out to be a kav plus. Sariach means an extra. So for two kav worth of dates, you end up with a kav worth of pits. So basically, it's more than half of the volume of the date is in its pits. For two kav worth of dates, one of those kavim, v'sariach, and more, is the pits of the dates. You're asking the same question Yushami asked. Is volume determined by the airspace in between, or do you squeeze down the airspace once you're taking the pit out? Once you take in the pit out, if he squares down the airspace, then it's not so crazy. Again, if you're dealing with weight, then for sure, it could be this way. Kav is a measurement of volume, not weight. A date with its pit and without its pit makes no difference if you just leave the airspace there. Question is, if you squeeze it back down from the airspace, then it makes a difference. And that's likely what you have to do here in order to get that smaller amount. So he says, that's the answer. And therefore, we're not worried about this. A kotevet is a little more than a beitza, but by two kotovot without their pits in them, you're not going to get to that full size because the pit is a little more than half of the date. If I take 2 dates without their pits, I'm not going to equal a single date with its pit. And therefore, it'll be less than a kibetza. So that's why the Gemara answers it deals with this issue. All right, now, a couple of things that we want to discuss over here. One is, the Tosfot here takes up another issue. It's about Berach Acharav. Why is it that he didn't make a bracha afterwards? So the first thing he said is, because he paskins like the Mand Omar, that it's a kibetza is the threshold. Tosfot says, v'nir the reed, that the loch is like the one who says kazayit. And we paskin that way, that if you eat a kazayit already, you have to bench. Kibetza is not the threshold for benching. So that's number one. Now, number two, Tosfot takes up a different issue, which is what's called kibriyata. Kibriyata is when you eat an item entirely. If you eat a whole item, what is the din there? We have this, for instance, in Isurim. By Isurim, if one eats an ant is less than the requisite size to be chayav. Nevertheless, you're chayav because it's a briyata. It's a complete beria. Since it's a complete beria, therefore it has chashivut. It's given a chashivut as if it is the requisite side. Based on that, he says, Yerushalmi seems to indicate that the same is true by fruits. For instance, if you take a kazayit and you eat an olive, a whole olive, do you have to make a bracha achrona? Now, a whole olive is not the size of a kazayit, because a kazayit is an olive with its pit. But if you're eating kazayit, you're not eating a kazayit with its pit, you're eating just a kazayit. That's how the Yerushalmi deals with a stira about Rabbi Yochanan eating kazayit and not making a bracha achrona. So Yerushalmi says, well, he did have to make a bracha achrona because he ate the whole olive. Yerushalmi seems to indicate that if you eat the entire birya, you'd have to make a bracha achrona, even if you're below the requisite shiur or threshold. He says, our Gemara answers the question about Rabbi Yochanan differently and seems to argue on that. He says Rabbi Yochanan was eating small kazayit. He was eating a big kazayit. And that's why you eat the requisite shear. From our Gemara, it makes it sound like, even if you eat a whole olive, you would not have to make the bracha achrona, even though it's a whole birya. According to Shami, it sounds like it is. So he tried to reconcile between the two cases. But he says that the bracha achrona, he thinks you have to make when you eat a whole fruit. And that's the way we paskin. That if you eat an entire grape, even though you may not meet the requisite shear, if you eat a whole date, a whole fig, a whole olive, then you have to make a bracha achrona, even though you haven't met the requisite shiur, because you've eaten an entire birya. So to have a single grape, you would have to make a bori pre'etz beforehand, and then an ale etz v'alpi'etz afterwards, even though you didn't meet the requisite shiur of kizayit to make a bracha achrona. The last thing he says is, despite the fact that you don't have to make a bracha achrona, you still have to make a bracha rishona. So he says, even though the Gemara in Brachot makes it sound like it's a kal v'chomer, why do we make a bracha rishona? Because the Torah tells you make a bracha achrona. Kal v'chomer, you should have to make a bracha rishona. After you're satisfied you make a bracha, then certainly when you're still hungry and you're going to eat it, you should make a bracha beforehand. Well, if you don't make a bracha achrona, maybe you shouldn't have to make a bracha rishona, because the kal v'chomer falls apart then. So he says, the Kav HaChomer is not for real, because if it was for real, then you'd be Chayav Deoraita to make a Bracha Rishona. And we know that Brochot Rishonot are all Mi'id Rabbanan. The only Brochot Mi'id Deoraita is benching, Birkat HaMazon, and possibly Birkat HaTorah. But nobody says Bracha Rishona is Mi'id Deoraita. If the Kav HaChomer was for real, then you would take a Doraita din of Bracha Achrona and bring it to Bracha Rishona. It would make Bracha Rishona Doraita. It's one of the Shlosh Yisrei Midot HaTorah of Rabbi Shmuel. You'd be able to make it Doraita. The fact that it isn't shows you that's not the case. He says you have to make a bracha rishona even for the smallest amount. It doesn't matter what the threshold is. You have to make a bracha rishona. In terms of liquids, he has some questions about what the threshold for liquids is. Here the Gemara says melol lugmav is the threshold for Yom Kippur. He says maybe that's not true by liquids for bracha achrona. Maybe bracha achrona is guided by kazayit as well, and not by melol lugmav. And he discusses it the rest of the daf today. I'll show you where he discusses why liquids might be different in terms of the machlok between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. So that's an important Tosfot in terms of halacha lemaisa. Right now, we have another opinion. Rav Amar, haltam hainu taima l'shum da'av alei pere. You're comparing apples and oranges, or you're comparing fruits and bread. Why is the same thing? He says, pere lo ba'i sukkah. You eat fruits, you don't need to go to the sukkah. The reason that he's machmir himself has nothing to do with the quantity of fruits. It has to do with fruits themselves. Inherently, fruits do not require sukkah. The reason that he went up to the sukkah was machmir himself. Rabbi Tzadok was eating bread. There, kibetza makes a difference. There, you must go to the sukkah. And therefore, he had a problem comparing the wrong things. There's no question here because you drew a parallel between two cases that are not parallel. So, meitavei, amr rabbi, kishainu lomdim Torah itzel Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua, viu lefeneinu te'inim vanavim vachlunum achilat arai chutz l'sukkah. When we were learning about Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua, they brought us te'inim vanavim, and we ate them outside of the sukkah, achilat arai, which is a snack. So, achilat arai in achilat kevalo makes it sound like only because it was a achilat arai, that it was a temporary or a snack, that we were allowed to eat it outside the sukkah. Had we been koveya suda, peirot would have been required to be in this sukkah. Ema, you have to amend the statement, achalnum keachilat arai chutz l'sukkah. Now, we ate them like a snack outside the sukkah. Not because the achilat arai was the determining factor, but it didn't matter. It's just because it was fruit. Because it's fruit, by definition, it's a snack outside of the sukkah. Now, we ate them as a fixed meal, I mean, we sat down to eat them, but we ate bread, achilat arai. Because of that, we ate chutz l'sukkah. Because the bread was arai, and the fruits were keva, therefore we didn't go into the sukkah. Now, the only reason you would have bread as an arai in these situations is where you're using the bread to offset the taste of the other item. We have that by dag maliach. Very salty fish, which is inedible without having the bread there. So you only eat the bread to make the fish edible. So therefore the bread's not being used for its primary purpose as bread, it's simply as a mitigator to the fish. It's very hard to make bread tafel. This is one place that the Gemara mentions it as being tafel. I would suggest it's the same thing here by the fruits. He's in the same thing, which is that fruits we're talking about are very sweet. So sweet that they need something to mitigate the sweetness of the fruits. So also over here, the bread here is simply to facilitate the eating of the fruit. And by doing that, the bread is arai vis-a-vis the fruits. And that's what he was suggesting over there. Lema misayile. Let's say that helps this explanation. The fikach. Imishlim b'minei targimah yatsa. If you finish up your 14 meals with minei targimah, you're yotze. V'isak adat kol perei v'isukah litnei peirot. And you should read in peirot. This is according to the opinion. We'll get this in the Gemara and Sukkah. It's a machloket of how many sudot that you have to eat over sukkot. So the Rabbanan believe you only have to eat one meal, which is on the first night. You have to eat in the sukkah. After that, everything is reshut, is optional. On the other hand, Rabbi Eliezer believes that you have to eat 14 meals in the sukkah, two meals a day in the sukkah that are obligatory. So it says there that in order to finish up those meals, imishlim imine targima, it's okay. If you didn't eat hamotzi for 14 meals, but you use mini targima on the last meal or one of the meals, that's okay. So the Gemara says, if you think that you're obligated to eat peirot in the sukkah, it should have said in the Braita that you can finish it up with peirot, because peirot would be classified as something you must eat in the sukkah. The Gemara says, wait a minute, my mini targima, peirot. That's exactly what mini targima are. Mini targima are fruits. So it's exactly what it's saying. Why do they mention targima? Because it's a place where there are no fruits. Had there been a place that they had fruits, they would have mentioned fruit. They were just mentioning what was available to them in that location. What's available to them is targima.
So targima
is mizonot, most likely. That's the way Tosafot explains it, that it's mine mizonot. Rashi in other places writes, and this is what Tosafot takes into the task, where Perish Rashi gone peirot, v'kisnin, v'kaflutot mevushalim. So Rashi says in another place, mine targima are fruits. Kisnin is pataba v'kisnin. Those are things that are wrapped in dough, like a calzone or a wrap. V'kaflutot, which are certain vegetables that are cooked. So all of these items he mentions as mine targima. Tosafot says, it's clear from here that the Gemara thinks that peirot and targima are not equated. I mean, there's one day here that it is, but it seems the Gemara separates between the two. Based on that, he says, by Shudash Lishit, on Shabbat, what can you eat over there? If you say that you can be Yotzei, the Shudash Lishit with Mine Targima, that still doesn't mean you can eat fruits, according to Tosafot. Tosafot says, for Shudash Lishit, if you agree that you can use Mine Targima, he thinks that's not even true. Says, first of all, I think you should have to wash for all three meals, because they learned it out from the mon. It says ayom three times by the mon, and therefore you have to have three meals. But based on that, he says you need to wash for all three meals, and you can have bread at all three meals. He says, even if you believe that you can use mine targima, the definition of mine targima is not fruits. And therefore fruits do not work. You can have mizonot for sudash lishit, but not items like fruits that for sudash lishit. The halacha, the Mishnah Berurah brings down in terms of hierarchy, the best way to have sudash lishit is lechem mishnah. If you don't have lechem mishnah, it's to wash for something that is lechem or forced to wash. Otherwise, mine name is zonot. And the last passage is Yesh Omrim. He says that you can use fruits. He does bring down a daya. There is a daya, and obviously Tosafot is fighting against that daya here and saying that fruits do not qualify for sudash lishit. But of course, in the hierarchy, it's the bottom of the rung. But there are deot that say that you could use fruits based on this, and mini targima work for Suda Shlishit. And if you define mini targima as fruits, then you would be able to use fruits for the Suda Shlishit. Tosafot obviously does not think that way. Now we have an alternative opinion that Ri measures the Kotev Ragasa, and Rav Zvir Amar, Kotev Ragasa Shamru, Kaseira Mi Beitza. It's just a little less than a Kabeitza. So now all the questions we had before are not a question because it's less than a Kabeitza. So then we don't have our issue anymore. Tetnan. Beit Shammai Omim Seor B'Kazayit Chametz B'Kotevet. This we're going to come to in First Mishnah in Beitza. Beit Shammai says that Seor on Pesach, to be violate Seor, you have to have a size of a Kazayit. Chametz is B'Kotevet. V'Avinam Ba, my time of the Beit Shammai. What is the reasoning behind Beit Shammai? Why is Seor and Chametz have different measurements or thresholds to be violate on Pesach? Why is Seor in a Kazayit and a Chametz is a date size versus an olive size? So Nichtov Rachmana Chametz. Fellow by Seor, because the Torah should have just written Chametz, and we would have known that Seor is restricted. But Amina, ma Chametz shein chimutzo kasher, Chametz that itself is risen, but it can't cause other things to rise. Asur b'kazayit, that has a threshold of a kazayit, Seor shein chimutzo kasher. Seor, which not only can rise itself, but it can cause others. It's a trigger for other things to rise. Lo kol shekein, certainly you could have a kazayit. Me de palginu rachmano, since the Torah split them, this is like a shorthand of the Gemara in Beitza. The Gemara there goes through the whole limud of the psukim, lo yalecha, lo yalecha, that it says it by Seor, and it says it by Chametz. Limda lecha shiro shozeh, lo kishiro shozeh. It teaches you that the shiur of the Chametz is not similar to the shiur of Seor. Seor b'gzayit, v'chametz b'kodevet. V'isak adatcha, if you think kodevet agasah shermu yoterim mikabetza, if you think that kodevet agasah is greater than a kabetza, michte. Beit Shammai is shiro denafish mikazayit kemahadre. They're looking for the next step up from a kazayit. Because they said, look, the Torah tells me achila. Achila is a kazayit. But I already have that by Seor. So now, what do I do by Chametz? Chametz, which is a lesser of the two. Seor is the more pernicious. So therefore, I say, that's a kazayit. If I say Chametz, it's got to be a greater size. So what do I do? I say, I look for the next thing up. What's the next measurement up? Well, they came out with a kotevet. If a kabetza was the next size up, they would have said kabetza, not a kotevet. What does that show you? That a kotevet must be smaller than a kabetza. If you think the kotev is greater than a kabeitza, let them write a kabeitza. If you think they're equal. Let's say a kotev and a beitza are exactly equal, so he gave you one of the two. Let them write a kabeitza. And it would have been the same thing. People know a kabeitza a lot more than a kotevet. It's clear here that a kotevet is less than a kabeitza. Mar says, Mimai, how do you know that's true? Dilma the olam emelecha, I can tell you, kotevet agasa shamru yeteira mikabeitza. It's more. Hastama. But, in general, it's a kabeitza. So this is the point that we made before, that the kotevet that's mentioned in the Mishnah is a fat date. So a fat date is bigger than a kabeitza. A standard kotevet is the same size as a kabeitza. Inami, keadati ninu, or they're equal. He says two answers to you. Number one is, maybe a kotevet agasa is bigger than a kabeitza, but a regular kotevet is less than a beitza, and it solves the whole problem. Number two is, maybe they're equal. Kotevet and a beitza are equal, so why did he write kotevet? Because he picked one of the two. You have to pick one, so he picked kotevet. Why would he pick beitza? I mean, it's true, the beitza is a little easier to work with than kotevet, because we find beitza so much. But I was saying, he picked one of the two, they picked a kotevet. I don't have any proof from here that a kotevet is less than a beitza. That's what the Gemara says. Ad kama mizamnim. How much do you have to eat in order to be mizamein? It says, ad kazayit, divrei Rabbi Meir. Biyod omer, ad kabeitza. This is the machloka that we spoke about before. What triggers benching? Rabbi Meir believes that it's a kazayit that triggers benching. Rabbi Yehuda says it's a kabeitza that triggers benching. So Rabbi Tzadok held like Rabbi Yehuda. But Maika Miflagate, what are they arguing about? Rabbi Meir, Sarvar, the posuk says, ve'achalta, visavachta, uveirachta. Achalta, zu, achila. Visavata, zu, shtia. Ve'achila, bekazayit. So the trigger for benching is ve'achalta. The kazayit triggers benching because ve'achalta means achila. Achila is a shiur achila. Rabbi Yehuda savar, achalta visavata. Achila sheish batzvia. That's the eating that is satisfying. That's the only time you bench. What is that? Beis says, it's a kabeitza. That's the size of an egg. V'isach adat v'kodevet agasa shemur yetera mikabeitza. If you say a fat date is greater than a beitza, than an egg. Hashta kabeitza svuye misba adat lo mitva. You're telling me that a kabeitza is enough to satisfy you, but not enough to take away the inoy? How could it be? Person's fully satisfied with the kabeitza, yet that's not enough to be mitva date, to put him at ease? Elav shvamina kodevet agasa shemur pachot mikabeitza. That it's less than a kabeitza. Kabeitza misba. A kabeitza satisfies. Kotevet mitva date. And a kotevet which is less than a kabeitza puts your mind at ease. It doesn't satisfy you, but it puts you at ease. from the inui. So from this we prove that a kotebet gasa must be less than the size of a kebetza. This is what Tosfa was quoting before, a question about shtia. Achalta v'savata, according to Rabbi Huda, is savata is defining what the achila is. On the other hand, Rabbi Meir says, v'achalta v'savata, achila is achila, savata is shtia, which seems to indicate that shtia, you would have to have zvia. According to Rabbi Meir, you would have to be satisfied with the drink. What's the size of the satisfaction by a drink? So it's also what said before, maybe Rabbi Meir's size for satisfaction is a kebetza for drinking. You'd have to drink a kebetza's worth in order to be satisfied. And there it would turn out that the size for solid items would be a kezayit, and the size for liquid items would be a kebetza, a greater size, according to Rabbi Meir. Because he has the word svia together with the shtia. Rabbi Yehuda, on the other hand, says, v'achalta v'savata, the savata is defining the achila, and therefore the achila is a kebetza. But you see the word svia means kebetza. According to that, so it says, Rabbi Meir would have a higher threshold of liquids than solids.
Where
does the Melo Lugma? So that's what Tosfot says. What about the Melo Lugma in our Mishnah? It says, Melo Lugma in our Mishnah is mitzvah date. That's about just putting your mind at ease. That's not satisfaction. Satisfaction is a greater level. But then in the end, he backs away from it and says, maybe my liquids are different than solids, and svia by liquids would come at a kezayit. Even though Rabbi Yehuda believes svia by a solid only comes at a kebetza, maybe for liquids it would come already at a kezayit. We need less liquids to be satisfied than with a solid. And therefore he backs away from that chiddush that maybe you would have to say, we pass him like Rabbi Meir. If we pass him like Rabbi Meir, it would be that kezayit is the threshold for achila, for solids, and a kebetza would be the threshold for liquids. So he backs away from that chiddush and says, maybe by liquids the din is different for svia, and a kezayit is the right level for liquids to be satisfied. They will stop over here.